Okay, we'll call the House Resources Committee meeting to order, and the recording secretary make note it's 5 minutes after 1 o'clock. And if you will, call the roll. Yo.
Representative Guttenberg. Representative Petula.
Here.
Representative Masick.
Here.
Representative Gatto.
Here.
Representative Pine.
Here.
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 Here. And I see Representative Seaton, and I see Senator Stevens, who will probably be up here testifying. We had room up here. There is probably for Representative Seaton's, and I suppose that Senator Stevens will be probably having his own chair up here for in just a moment. Going to take up real quickly SDR 12. I think that we can dispense with that, and then we're going to take up 105, HB 105, which has an HB behind it because at one time Senator Stevens was actually on the other side of this aisle and submitted that bill at that time. So with that, if everybody would prepare to get SJR number 12, this is supporting the halibut bycatch utilization project of the Alaska Food Coalition. And we have, let's see, do we have anybody to testify this? Yes, we have online Trevor Jones. Are you there, Trevor?
I am here, and I don't have any particular testimony at this time, but I just wanted to be here to answer any questions that the committee might have, and we'll respectfully listen in and field any questions and be available for those.
Good. I appreciate your being there online with us this afternoon. Is there anybody from the audience who would like to testify to the joint resolution 12? If not, then we will, that was real quick, we'll close public testimony and we will discuss SGR 12 in the committee. My intent is to pass this out. If there's no discussion, we will entertain a motion, therefore. Yes?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if Senator Stevens wants to give any information on it to put on the record, but I guess the resolution does speak for itself. Having said that, Mr. Chairman, I would like to make the motion to move out the CS for Senate Joint Resolution Number 12, the resource version, out of committee with the attached fiscal notes and ask for individual recommendations and unanimous consent.
Is there any objection? There seems to be one.
No, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair, no objection here. We're going to let the Senator off without...
That's right.
He has 105 yet to come before, so I'm not sure we're going to let
I him. Have no problem, no objection.
No objection. There being no... Representative Gatto.
Point of order. Representative Masick said the CS for a Senate joint resolution. Actually, I have the House CS for the CS for the Senate. And so, just for clarity.
Yes, for Senate Joint Resolution Number 12, the resource version.
That's what I have.
And that's 23-LS0787.
Okay.
Class D.
Sorry,
and
my error.
And amend my emotion, reflecting that it says Senate Joint Resolution. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Right. That is correct. That's the document that we're reading from. Is there any other point to be taken up or other objection to the motion?
Well, I've got a point then because I've got a House CS, a fish version.
I have.
Mm-hmm. It's the most recent on 417, and I think that's probably the one we want to move instead of the Senate CS. Or do we have...
There'll be a short of these here. Yes.
Actually, the one...
And I will rescind my action on it and give a new motion that we... pass out the House CS for CS for Senate Joint Resolution Number 12, the fish version, and 23-LS0787-H version. And ask again for unanimous consent with the attached fiscal notes and ask for individual recommendations.
Is there any objection?
Object?
Yes.
I'd like to hear Senator's comments.
What's your objection? You just want to hear his comments?
Yeah. I I think you mentioned that there was just the fourth whereas. Was that what line 10 on page 1 was the change?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Yeah, if you look on page 2, line 6 through 8, there was a change in the Fish Committee, Special Committee on Fish, just to make it absolutely clear that this is a specific permit. It's called the Prohibited Species Donation Permit. It's authorized by the National Marine Fisheries Service, and it's to use halibut catch from vessels with observers. So we want to make it absolutely clear that no fish would be used from vessels that do not have observers, but only those vessels that have federal observers aboard to make sure that no one is playing fast and loose with keeping certain halibut. So it's only from observed vessels. So that was the change made in Fish Committee. Absolutely right. I'm glad they did that. It just clarifies what we're trying to do here.
Okay, that's clarified. Will you withdraw your objection now?
I do.
Okay, thank you very much. Any other objections? There being none, the movement of House CS for CS for Senate Joint Resolution Number 12 is passed. Now we will go to HB 105. Yes, sir. Cheryl does, yeah.
Right. Lift me again.
Okay, to make sure we're on the right version.
Do that.
House Bill number 105, this version 23-LS0534/D. Has everybody got the D version? Okay, we have online with us.
Where is the bill?
191-05. We don't have anybody online for 105. Do we have anybody? Pardon? Petersburg? Just gave it to me. 191. I see, okay. Sorry about that. Okay, we have Joseph Lanham from Petersburg. Are you there with us today, Joseph?
Yes, I am.
Would you like to testify on HB 105?
Yes, I would.
And state your name and your affiliation, please.
Okay, my name is Joseph Lanham. The organizations that I work for, are not in on this, so I'm just representing myself today. I had four concerns that I just wanted to go over. The first one was that if you finance the bill of the fishermen so that the permit, the tax bill that is, so that the permit cannot be seized, you are in most cases just delaying the inevitable. The only reason they would need to pay taxes is because they made money or made profits. If they made money, then the taxes should have come out of those profits first and saved for taxes. So then it was their choice to get into that situation in many cases because they would have misallocated their funds. This being said, there's no policy in the bill that says that the state loan officers for the Division of Investments have to show any kind of debt service ratios that show that the fishermen can pay the estimated taxes for next year, as well as the new current portion of long-term debt. My second concern is, what is the loan loss reserve? It says that the program was highly used, but does not say how much these loans cost the fund in delinquencies or cost the fund in constant deferrals. Are these some of these loans that were booked back then when the program was highly used still receiving deferrals and still only receiving interest payments? I may be wrong, but I have heard from several fishermen that they receive deferrals from the state constantly. The third one is the waiver of the loan fee of the 0.5%. I disagree with this because whether the state realizes it or not, the Division of Investments competes with the commercial banks. Lowering the fee will make companies who lend to the commercial fishing industry more uncompetitive with the program, whose original intent was not to compete with banks. However, the state has become the lender of first choice instead of the lender of last resort. The state can refinance up to $300,000 and thus has resulted in the loss of profitable customers who have never missed a payment and never have been late and are in no current jeopardy of doing so. They do this by subverting the requirement to have a decline letter from the bank and having the customer qualify for bank financing through the bank by refinancing it back to the state. The state loan officers instruct fishermen to come to the bank to set interim or bridge financing. What this is the customer actually comes in, qualifies for conventional financing, and does not need the state. But the state, under the refi program, pays off a good performing loan and then takes it over from us and uses us in a way to get around the $100,000 limit. This is a deceptive practice because it just disguises the fact that they are initiating loans over $100,000, which is the new money limit that they have. State loan officers will go as far as to send commitment letters to the borrower assuring them that if they qualify for bank financing, they will refinance and do the deal. My last concern is the only people who can foreclose on permits is the IRS or the state of Alaska or its authorized financing companies such as CFAB or the Division of Investments. Banks are prohibited by the state to finance limited entry permits. The phrase in HB 105 that talks about stopping creditors is really only referring to the IRS, the state, and CFAB. The state and CFAB can make their own decision whether or not to foreclose on the permit in the interest of the state, as they are in the interest of the fishermen in the first place, and if it is good for the fishing community. If the IRS forecloses on the permit, their only interest is to turn it into cash to pay a tax bill. To do that, it would have to be resold, and the only people that would buy a limited entry permit are fishermen who would fish it. So if the permits are to be foreclosed on and then sold, there wouldn't have the dire consequences referenced in the bill because the permits would be fished. If any of the members have any further questions of me on the Division of Investments and my experience getting refinanced on my deals, they can just contact me through the LIO, and then that's it.
Okay. Will you be able to stay online for a while?
Yes, I will.
Yeah, because our sponsor's here, and I don't want to delay it any farther. I did want to engender some questions here, which I think that you have. And with that, I'm going to apologize for not allowing the sponsor to start the public testimony right off the bat, but I think that it probably got his adrenaline going and gave him not only that, but a good opportunity to answer some of these questions, which I'm sure he would like to. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to give you a little background on this bill, where it came from is the Joint Legislative Task Force, which you as a House and the Senate appointed last year, and it met during the summer and the fall of this last year before the session started. And out of that Joint Legislative Task Force came about a half a dozen bills that are moving their way through the legislature right now. They're all intended to try to help an industry that's in crisis. And I guess that's really what we have to begin with, is that the salmon industry is in crisis. There are enormous problems that the industry is facing in terms of farm fish, tremendous production. There's a lot more product on the market than there was before when we were the only ones in the market. Now we're facing that competition of a tremendous amount of product on the market throughout the world. The second issue that we're facing in the salmon industry is a very low price right now, a very low price for our salmon. So what we're seeing is a lot of fishermen that are putting themselves in tremendous jeopardy with the possibility of losing their business, of going out of business. And in response to the speaker earlier who had called in, the whole issue of foreclosures, that is certainly not in the state's best interest to have to see fishermen go out of business, to see them lose their permits, to see them foreclosed upon. So the purpose of this bill is to try to forestall that, to try to help fishermen. And to answer some of the specific questions about misallocating funds, I don't believe that's certainly not the intention here. This loan program, and it is a loan program to help with federal taxes. It helps fishermen pay their federal taxes when they're in such a position of jeopardy right now. It's been done before. The state has had this program from 1995 through 97 and from 2001 to 2003. It was, as the speaker earlier said, it was very widely used. It was very successful. It helped a lot of people during that time. The question of delinquency, I don't have those figures, but we need to ask the Division of Investment. They are here, and they can tell you exactly what those delinquencies are. The 0.5% waiver is simply to make it to help out fishermen even more, and I think that speaks to most of the issues that the speaker brought up. So, in any event, Mr. Chairman, this is a program that's worked before. It's a program that the Salmon Task Force thought would help the industry this time around, and I sure encourage you to give it some serious consideration.
Thank you very much. Questions of Senator Stevens? Your Representative Guttenberg.
Sure. What about the comment that the gentleman just made online that this is only delaying the inevitable?
Well, I guess what I'd have to say to the chair is that the last two times it's been tried, in 95 through 97 and 2001 to 2003, it did help fishermen out. It did delay the time in which they face bankruptcy, and it is not inevitable that they are going to go into bankruptcy. Sometimes people just need a little time in the hope that the monies that we are putting into, say, marketing through Senator Ted Stevens, that $20 million going into salmon marketing will help the industry out in the hopes that the prices will get a little bit better, and in the hopes that we'll be in a more competitive position knowing the quality of our product as compared to farm fish, and in the hopes, I assume, that the public will begin to learn the problems that farm fish faces in terms of pollution and all the negative things we've heard about farm fish. So I don't think you can say that it's delaying the inevitable. It's not inevitable that all of these fishermen who are having trouble paying their taxes right now are going to go out of business and lose their permits. I don't think that is inevitable. And I think the fact that this program has been successful for these two periods of time only goes to show that it is not inevitable. We can help pull them out.
Representative Guttenberg, go follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we've done it twice before. Do we know the default rate?
And that was a question that was asked Representative Guttenberg earlier through the chair. I don't have that, but I know the Division of Investment can certainly will be able to answer that question on default and delinquencies.
Thank you, Representative Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stevens, I was wondering about the fiscal note down here. Says here that the current law requires the division to charge 0.5% of the fee to refinance. Section 1 of the bill removes that 0.5% refinancing fee that will result in a reduction of income to the CFRLS, and I'm wondering why was that language put in to remove that?
I think through the chair, at this point, there's no necessity of doing that. The program has been successful in the past. This is just a further encouragement to fishermen to use this program and to make it less expensive.
Yes, follow-up.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm really troubled with this piece of legislation because we have in our state, a lot of people have to pay federal taxes, but the state does not go back and help them out, like for interest with homeowners or a business owner that are way back in their federal taxes. We don't help them as a state, so I'm really troubled with it because it's pretty self-centered, and at the time of where we're at, the fiscal crisis that we're in today, I just am real troubled with it, and I'm not happy to see that the Section 1 of it had removed that 0.5% because due to the trouble that we are facing in the state, and I've brought it up before, and I'll bring it up again, like with the issue in Canada, when they had trouble with their fishing industry, what Canada did was looking at helping those fishermen to join a different labor force, to be trained in some other occupation, because, the fish is not going to be here to make a living for a lot of people forever. So, I'm seeing this coming, this state is probably going to be coming down in that avenue. So I think, the more that we're doing here, I appreciate the fact of it, but I just think it's really self-serving, and I just am real troubled with it. Thank you.
Representative Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Stevens, we had this bill in fisheries, didn't we? Pass it out of fisheries?
Yes.
Okay, I'm supportive of this bill. I was just curious that in the past the IRS has taken limited entry permits.
No. Maybe Cheryl Sutton, if you don't want Mr. Chairman, can answer that. She's been working on this bill through Senator Ben Stevens' office.
Cheryl Sutton, staff to Senator Ben Stevens in the task force. Thus far we have been successful in not having the IRS seize any permits, largely due to the fact that Bruce Twomley with CFEC has been very successful in this area. And a large portion of this bill has to deal with that subject. We are trying to protect the state's interests in this. I mean, it's clearly in the state's interest not to lose permits. And if I might speak to Representative Masick's questions that she had, the 0.5%, the reason that it was recommended by the task force to remove the 0.5% refinancing fee is to just as an additional help for folks who want to refinance their loans and take advantage of lower interest rates and not have to incur those costs. I want to point out that this is a revolving loan fund, and it's somewhat different from some other references that were made, in that the last appropriation, GF appropriation to this, was in FY85, and so it's a self-perpetuating. The, you know, the borrowers are the people who are, you know, putting the money back into the fund, and so it's the 0.5% removal was just something that the task force felt that they could do to help fishermen who wanted to refinance and take advantage of lower interest rates and not have that additional cost in refinancing.
Any further? Yes, Representative Dotto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. How long has the fund been self-sustained? This old?
Self-sustained.
Well, it's revolving so that the state doesn't need to inject periodic money into it. So how long has it been in existence on a sustained basis without state input or injection of money?
To the chair, Representative Gettle. The last appropriation from the state was in FY85.
Follow up. Then the 0.5% forgiveness is easily absorbed by the fund, and they're willing to absorb it in order to keep. And I guess what I'm trying to get is, if they default with the IRS, it's in your best interest, our best interest, to prevent that. And so we're investing part of the loan capital in trying to avoid that. And what I want to know is, when that happens, when IRS simply comes to collect because they're out of money, do they get their permit?
Through the chair, Representative Gettle, that's a question that Mr. Twomley from CFPC can speak to, and he has a long experience in dealing with the IRS. Our whole objective is not to allow the IRS to seize a state asset, which is a limited entry permit. And we might be a little confused on a couple of elements in the bill. The 0.5% refinancing fee really has nothing to do with the IRS loans, which this bill is seeking to reinstate a program that was in existence in the past and used. And I want to point out that the people who are most at risk in this area are folks who have no other economy apart from commercial fishing, mostly those in Western Alaska. And I'm sorry that they're not online to testify to this bill today, because we heard immense testimony through the task force. And you know, our interests are in keeping these, you know, this is a state loan program only for state residents, and our interests are in keeping these permits in the villages, in rural areas where people have no other economy. And so it serves a dual purpose in that regard. But Mr. Twombly can speak much more eloquently to that than I.
Representative Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stevens, I was curious about the language on page 3, lines 7 through 12. Because of lack of training or lack of employment opportunities in the areas of residence, does not have occupational opportunities available other than commercial fishing, or is economically dependent on commercial for fishing for a livelihood, or for whom commercial fishing has been a traditional way of life in Alaska. I guess I wanted to just add something to that section, because currently we have our Alaska, since the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act passed, and with all the federal funding for BIA, we have a lot of federal dollars. We have a lot of state dollars that's invested continuously through nonprofit organizations, for-profit organizations that do have the ability to help these folks that live out in these underlying areas. And as an Alaska Native myself, having grown up in a small village of less than 100 people, you know, we relied on fishing. But now my father's fishing permit is useless. And so they do have other funding to retrain him, but the only jobs that are available are basically federal or state or municipal or through tribal entities. So I just kind of take that into strong consideration, because I don't think that's a very fair statement to put into this bill here, because there are other opportunities available. It's just up to the individual person on how, if they want to further their training in other areas. So I'm just wondering if you could give me some input back as to why this new language has been added into this bill.
Well, sorry, through the chair, Representative Masick. I can speak for the villages in my community, in my area. I have six villages on Kodiak Island. They're all coastal villages, all villages that depend heavily on salmon industry, on salmon fishing, and traditionally have fished salmon for years. You're right that if fishing goes away and they're no longer able to commercial fish, then there are other programs that can help them. But those are all social programs, giveaway programs to keep people, to provide people with food and the things they need. I can speak for the fishermen that I know in Kodiak, and specifically speaking about a village in Old Harbor. They don't want those giveaway programs. They want to be able to compete. They want to be able to have jobs that they can create. They want to be able to fish, and that's the only jobs that they will have available to them. There are a few other jobs that maybe are supported by state and federal funds to help people through the winter, but that's not what they're looking for. They're not looking for a handout. They're looking for help to keep on in the fishing industry, which they know well, and they've performed well in for years. So I think what you said sort of plays right into what I'm trying to say, too, that, you know, we need to make sure that they can continue to provide themselves jobs and be competitive so that they're not on the public dole.
Can you follow up, Mr.
Yes.
Chairman? I guess I just don't understand why you had to include this in the language, and if I had the choice, I would just to respect on what you're trying to do with this legislation, I would ask to have the line 7 through 12 removed from the bill, but I'll leave it at the discretion of the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Masick. Representative Morgan?
I tend to try to agree with line 7 through 12, because I see no difference in the timber industry down here in Southeast Alaska. When that collapsed, who stepped in to provide training and try to build training and jobs and look at to retrain these people? As far as the social issues in Bush, Alaska, I do represent a lot of villages that only employment is social issues. But that's another new gamut. That's a fiduciary responsibility of the state and the federal government. It's not up to private. They do help private corporations too. I don't see nobody in any part of the U.S. or Alaska because of a social issue someplace in Alaska that the state or the federal government's asking that private company to take over the social problems. Private companies are here to make a profit. The state and the federal government are there to help socially as much as they can, whether it is through education, food stamps, welfare. And I do agree with Senator Stevens when he says, we do not want a handout. What's a better welfare than a paycheck? There's nothing better than that. And there's nothing better that makes a person feel good and independent than when they do work for a living and get a paycheck. And I do believe that training should be there. What kind? That would have to be, you know, looked into later. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? I have a couple here. this is a bill primarily to allow people to borrow money from the revolving fund to pay their income tax. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
I noticed that they have a two-year. What happens if they file for a delay? And I'm trying to think of the correct accounting word for this. But they file for delay, which takes up close to 9 months, and then they get into litigation over this tax, and it exceeds the 2 years from the date that you have specified here. Are there any remedies? Are there any?
I think
and that's, this could happen, incidentally. You file a late return, which goes from April 15th clear into September or October. October is when you have to come up with that late return. And then you find yourself in some kind of a legal situation where you still, it's indeterminate, or it's not determined whether or not you can still pay this, and it exceeds the 2 years from the time of application. Is there any kind of allowance for this?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, before I get myself in way over my head, which I probably have already, I would like to refer this to the Division of Investment. Greg is here, and I'm sure you can answer that question and do it right the first time. Where I'd appreciate you ask him that.
Right, and I will. The second thing is, how can a prudent businessman, whether it's a fisherman or who it is, allow themselves to get behind to that extent? And this is why I bring up that other first, because usually when that happens, you've either filed a late return or you have some disagreement with the IRS as to the amount of money. And so these things are mitigating circumstances that delay that payment. So the initial question really might have been, how many of these people do, and how can they not pay their taxes and save the money out? Because paying taxes implies that they've made a net income that's $30,000, which is the limit here, which is, we'll say in their event, is close to a net profit of about $100,000. So how can they get themselves behind that eight ball to where they owe that much income tax?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know as a businessman before your retirement, you certainly had a struggle as do all people.
I'm still struggling, Senator.
You're still struggling. You know, you think about the factors that really control a very small business of salmon fishing, you know, the market, the production of farm fish, all of that is beyond the control of the individual fishermen, and they find themselves in just a pretty terrible situation at times, and right now probably the worst situation they found themselves in the last 50 years with market conditions and the price. So those things, you know, you can be a very good fisherman and do everything right, but still find yourself in the hole at the end of the season because of the cost of refurbishing a boat, making it ready for the season, the nets you have to buy, the cost of getting ready, and all that. And if it's not a good season, they find themselves in a negative position. So you can't say that they are necessarily bad businessmen or bad fishermen because of that, but it's just the circumstances.
If they don't have a good season, they wouldn't have much of an income tax to pay, especially where they're writing off all those expenses. Income tax is predicated on your net income. That's what I'm trying to wrestle with. But maybe you've had somebody here that can answer this.
Yeah.
And also, there's other ways. You know, are they on a cash accounting or accrual accounting, which would make a difference relative, especially to the processors. If the processors, for example, don't pay them or wait to pay them or some of this thing, and they're on accrual, well, they've got to acknowledge that on their balance sheet.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And again, Greg Whittinger, I think, can help us out there a little bit.
Yeah, I would have him come to the table, or yeah, or Representative Gatto.
Thank you. Don't leave. On page two, the very beginning, Representative Masick brings up what I thought was some fairly interesting points, and Representative Morgan.
I asked the question, Representative Gatto, and they were going to have somebody up to ask to answer the question, and I would like my question answered, unless that relates to the question I asked.
Does not.
I would like to.
Thank you, sir, and we'll be available.
Right.
Greg,
you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Greg Winninger, Director of the Division of Investments. In regard to your question on the two-year requirement, I believe what you're referring to, Mr. Chairman, is in the eligibility section, and essentially the two-year requirement relates to the residency. As far as what taxes can be covered, it really doesn't. We can go back several years if necessary, but the two-year requirement just relates to you have to have been a resident for the last 2 years in order to qualify.
Are most efficient on a cash basis or on an accrual basis in their accounting system?
Mr. Chairman, I would say both, and some of them neither, is part of the problem that we're dealing with here. A lot of it is an education problem, and one of the things we've worked on very hard, in fact, since this program was initially introduced back in 95, was to try and do what we could to try and educate people, especially in rural Alaska, as to what kind of record keeping they need to do. We created a program called the Volunteer Tax and Loan Program, where we travel out to rural communities. It's a cooperative effort between us and the University of Alaska and the IRS to get out to these areas and to try and help people prepare tax returns at no expense, and to try and educate people as to what they need to do in regards to record keeping and to taking care of their IRS obligations so that this program is not necessary. And I think what's happened over the years is there's been quite a change. I mean, it's a much better situation now than when this program first started up. And part of that relates to, I think, the cooperative effort between CFEC, Bruce Twomley, and the IRS, and this particular program, and the Volunteer Tax and Loan, and all of these have been efforts to try and make this a smaller problem. And essentially what this bill does, it'll just give us another tool. We're talking probably 15 or 20 loans a year kind of thing. So it's not going to be a sweeping program. It's not going to, I think, cost the state much money. This loan fund has done very well. In regards to the delinquency rates, I can give you some information on that if you'd like, Mr. Chairman.
If you have it available immediately, it would be nice.
I do have that. Yeah.
Please.
Okay. Right now, we do have a fairly high delinquency rate in this portfolio. It's around 43%. But I think we should also point out that we've had 79 loans that have actually paid in full. We started out with a total of 307 loans that have been made over the life of this program. Most of those loans were made in the first 2 or 3 years of the program, and we had a real substantial non-compliance problem. In the last 3 fiscal years, we've made a total of 20 loans. So, again, it's a pretty small tool at this point in time. But we've had 79 loans paid in full. We've actually brought in a total of $5 million in payments, and that compares to $6.4 million that was actually loaned out. So we've actually gotten back the majority of the funds that were loaned out. Now, part of that is interest, but these are loans. They do need to be paid back. They are collateralized. It is true that we will work with borrowers. If they have difficulties, we have an extension program whereby we will work with them and try and get them through those difficulties. And a large part of that 44%, in fact, is what we're doing right now, is working with those individuals.
I have two other questions related to your testimony here. Are those collateralized with assets other than the limited entry permit?
Mr. Chairman, yes, they are in some cases. We have a combination of things. Many times there's other types of collateral as well as the permit. But I would say in most cases the permit is the primary collateral for the loan.
I guess that's for now all the questions. I think Representative Gatto is patiently waiting to ask his question.
See, now I've forgotten the question. I haven't actually. On page 3 at the beginning, it's required for the loan to satisfy, it says, either of Roman number, lowercase, 1, 2, or 3. And that's required. And it says either, and I don't know if either even is the proper English for that. It should have been any of or something like that. But I looked at it from the point of view of a loan being refused. Because it says if you have to satisfy one of these three, it looks like it's pretty easy for a person not to satisfy any of them in that... has been a crew member or commercial fishing license, et cetera, and many people simply don't qualify for that, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, I would say a lot of these for this particular program do, because in order to qualify, you have to have a permit, a limited entry permit that is in jeopardy of being taken back by the IRS. So there may be,
That adds a lot to it. Because then I was looking at two, and this is where Representative Matzik made a very good point. Because of lack of training or lack of employment opportunities in an area, well, there's always an employment opportunity. I guess you could do each other's laundry if you had to. So it's difficult to satisfy that requirement. Does not have occupational opportunities available other than commercial fishing. That's a pretty tough one to say I satisfy that requirement. So you default to number three, is economically dependent on commercial fishing for a livelihood and for whom commercial fishing has been a traditional way of life in Alaska. I don't know. I just wanted to put on the record that for me it seems like some people who you might purposely want to not give a loan to for some reason, you could find somewhere in these three in all of these three things where they might not qualify. And so Representative Maskett, though, was talking about on line just 7 through 12, was it? Line 7 through 12, and I'm kind of talking about lines 1 through 6 in addition to the 7 through 12. But you've already satisfied me, I guess, in number 1. Most everybody's going to qualify under number 1. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, yes, for this particular part of the program, yes, that's correct. And actually, where 2 and 3 come from is basically language that's already in the statute for Section B loans, and that language was actually put in back in the early to mid-80s at that point in time. I think the legislature felt that in order to qualify for this program, you needed to have some sort of commercial fishing experience or these other conditions met. So this language has been in the statute for going back to the mid-80s, I believe.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've sat here and listened to this, and I had some questions earlier, but this, I guess, raises the question. I heard 45% delinquency rate, is what I was told this morning. You've lost over $1 million. You're not talking about, I've heard we don't want a handout program, but asking for a 0.5% loan origination fee, and that's what I'm going to call it, reduction of that, losing $1 million plus and a delinquency rate of 45%, I call this a handout.
Through the chair, Representative Wolf. We have not lost, I wouldn't call it lost, $1 million. We do have a delinquency rate. We are working with those individuals, but that money has not been lost at this point. Now, it's true that we may lose some of that. These are collateralized loans. It could be that once we got through the foreclosure process, sold the asset, and if we did not recover enough, then we would have a loss against the fund. But I would not expect it to be, you know, in those kind of numbers. As far as the 0.5% fee goes, basically that relates to the refinancing program. And what has happened in the last couple of years is the rates have dropped dramatically. And so the majority of our portfolio has already refinanced. Now, as Senator Stevens mentioned, and during the task force process, there were a number of people that testified that were, you know, because of the difficulties, they were hoping that they would not have to pay that 0.5% fee in order to refinance their loans. It would have some impact on the fund, but because the rates have gone down so far at this point, most people have already refinanced. Now, if the rates drop further, you know, this fiscal note could be adjusted, but it's something on the order of, I think, $30,000 the first year and $13,000 for the next couple of years. So it will have an impact, but it isn't going to, I think, affect the financial integrity of this particular loan fund.
Follow up?
Yes.
Alaska Housing Finance program, you know, every time the interest rate goes down, people refinance. There's a loan origination fee that, you know, a bank. My wife is refinancing our house right now. We're paying the bank fee for it. Just because I'm bald, should I want 0.5% reduction. I mean, I have a problem with this one. We're in a situation where, with the state of Alaska, where we're talking about, you know, we're cutting programs, eliminating programs because we're running into a brick wall. And I guess my big problem is CFAB already does this, already is capable of doing this type of thing. And we have a state program that is doing this, and we're going to give them a half a percent. There's my crux. I mean, in 1987, when the economy went in the toilet, you could sit down in the Y in Soldotna and watch the contractors leave 24 hours a day because there was no work. They were dropping their keys off at the bank. The state didn't come in and bail them out. Now, I have no problems with helping out industry in the state of Alaska, but, you know, and I'm probably going to get beat up. My brother's going to probably call me tonight because he's a commercial fisherman in Bristol Bay. but I got a little bit of a problem with, you know, I want to help them out, but it seems like we're coughing up. We got private enterprise, well, CFAB. And we have a state program doing the same thing. And we're giving them a half a percent.
Do you want to respond?
Chair Representative Wolf, I wouldn't argue with you over the half percent. I mean, it is a relatively small fee. We have streamlined the process as best we can, but there are costs associated with doing a refinance. So it's not a large amount of money. It's a relatively small fee.
I guess it all adds up.
Right.
Any other? Yes, Representative Guttenberg.
What is the impact of the unrevolving loan fund at the 1.5% reduction based upon the default rate? Or even the delinquency? You know,
through the chair, as far as the effect of removing the 0.5%, we forecasted in 2004 it'd be about $30,200 and then 13.4 each year thereafter. It really is a factor of what interest rates do. If interest rates, for the most part, if the rates do not decline further, it will not be substantial. Now, if the Feds cut the rate again and the rates drop, then this fiscal note would probably go up to some extent because we would have a larger group that would be seeking refinancing. So it's really a factor of what the market rates do.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative Morgan.
What's the impact of the state of Alaska if these permits are lost to the IRS?
Through the chair, Representative Morgan, I think it'd be a pretty substantial impact, and actually Bruce Twomley could probably speak also to that issue. What we've tried to do with this program and with working with the IRS is to try and avoid that at all costs. We don't think it's in the state's interest to have the IRS start taking these permits and basically selling them to whoever they want,
bidder,
whatever they want. So that's the concern that we have, is that we've been trying to avoid that. We've been trying to work with the IRS and the fishermen through various programs like the Volunteer Tax and Loan and utilizing this program to try and avoid that possibility. But Bruce could speak to that as well.
Yes, we have with us Representative Seaton. I'm glad to have you up here at the chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to add a couple of things that we found out in Fisheries Committee, if that would be okay.
That's fine. Thank you very much.
In the Fisheries Committee, one of the things that you'll notice in here is that people have had to file tax returns and have made arrangements with the IRS. It's on the bottom of page 2, execute an agreement with the IRS. Mainly what these are is people in rural Alaska, in some cases, that didn't even know or realize that the IRS existed. And so they've accumulated, without accumulating receipts to write off expenses, they've accumulated an IRS debt. And like I say, in the Fisheries Committee, we found out that a number of these people really were even unaware that the IRS is out there. So we're dealing with a population that is being aided by this, and that's why the IRS and Division of Investments has come through with the tax writing program. So that is a section that this is addressing and is meant to help people through that time crunch and know how to retain records so that they can claim those expenses against their income, because otherwise the IRS doesn't allow those. And the 0.5%, you know, this industry is having problems right now. This doesn't cost the state of Alaska, the general fund, anything. This is the revolving loan fund. And the task force told us that one of the few ways in which they could help fishermen who are in a crunch because of salmon prices being down was to allow them to refinance their loans at the lower interest rates that are now and not charge them a 0.5% of the whole loan fee as an upfront fee. And then that could actually help people lower their ongoing expenses at this time when the salmon prices are so depressed. And so that was the rationale, really, for the half a percent refinance, not charging that refinance fee, to allow fishermen in this depressed industry to extend their payments, to reduce the cost without incurring this upfront cost.
Thank you very much. Enlightenment there. Thank you, Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Could any of this IRS obligation, is it allowed to be a result of some non-fishing obligation, such as child support from 10 years ago when they've got an agreement with IRS to pay it off, or is it restricted to IRS debt as a result of fishing?
Through the Chair, Representative Gatto, this particular language is restricted to the IRS. It's interesting you bring up the point about child support, because in the original legislation back in 95, there actually was a provision in the original bill to allow this to be used for child support as well. And there was a lot of concern about that part of the bill, and that was actually removed, you know, in one of the first hearings on the original legislation. So to answer your question, this is strictly for IRS obligations.
And I understand that, but is it obligations that are limited to debt as a result of fishing deficiencies or losing years, or can it be any debt?
Through the Chair, Representative Gatto, I think it can be any debt technically, but I don't recall any that fell into that category, but that could be possible, and I think under this language that would be possible.
I looked in the language and you know, to try to find a way for me to take care of myself and my gambling debt and saying, oh, can I get away with it? Yes, I can, unless I miss something, and that's really the reason for the question.
Through the Chair, Representative Gatto, I don't think there's any restriction as to what type of IRS debt you have incurred. The cases that I've seen have all been fishing-related, but I understand your point.
And I might add, that's a darn good question, Representative Gatto, because with only the two-year time frame that you've just explained has to come up here, they could carry an IRS, the possibility of at least they could carry that into, I don't know if they would, but any other questions? Just one here. The revolving fund is made up, basically, funded with GF funds?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Originally, the fund was created in 1972. There's approximately $60 million that went into the fund. There's been about $74 million that's actually gone back out of the fund since FY85 when the last appropriation was made.
It doesn't CFAB, I think that's the name of it, that was alluded to, which does the same thing, lend money for this same kind of an indebtedness?
Mr. Chairman, CFAB's program is a little different in that they're a co-op. And our programs do overlap to a small extent, but a large part of our program, basically, if you qualify for a CFAB loan, you do not qualify for a loan through us.
So there would be no conflict. There would be no, for example, competition between state-funded fund, which helps these people with their indebtedness, versus a CFAB. In other words, there's no competition. We're not doing what private industry should do.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there are a couple of areas where the two programs do overlap, and one of those areas is in the refinancing arena, which I think the person that called in talked about the refinancing arena. We do have the ability under current statute to refinance existing vessel and gear loans. We do not encourage people to take out bank loans and then come back to us, and in fact we're getting ready to implement a new regulation the next time we do regulations to make it clear that somebody has to have a loan on the books for at least a year before they can refinance, because we have no interest in having people go to the bank and then turn around and immediately refinance their loan. But that is an area right now under existing statute where, you know, there is some overlap. The other place that there is some overlap is under Section A permit loans. There's only two entities by law that can take a permit as collateral, Commercial Fish and Agriculture Bank and the state program. And in that area also, there's some overlap. But under Section B, which is our vessel loans, under Section C, which is quota share loans, we have specific language that says that those loans are intended for individuals that don't have other sources of financing.
Okay, thank you very much for that information. Are there any other questions? Are there any other people who would like, from the audience, who would like to testify here this this afternoon? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I would respond like Chairman of the Board of Industry Commission. These applications the program, people like
would you like to come up and identify yourself and make your statement here at the table?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bruce Twomley. I'm chairman of the Limited Entry Commission, and I would mainly like to be available to answer questions because we have had a stake in the program, but I would like to put the program in a context. We've had a lot of negotiations with the IRS about this. There was an IRS official in Anchorage, and this was less than 10 years ago, a gentleman named Chuck Strami. Chuck Strami went out to a meeting of the Alaska Association of Village Council Presidents in Kasigluk, and he came back. He was trying to simply make people aware of their tax obligations. He came back from that meeting, and his statement was, my God, we're trying to collect taxes from people who don't even know we exist. Don't even know we exist. So we had a situation within the last 10 years when we had people not knowing of their tax obligations, not filing tax returns, and these are in rural villages. When that happens, you know, the various penalties that attach can mount up into enormous tax debts very quickly. And, of course, distant IRS bureaucrats think that they've got someone guilty of tax evasion, and in some of those cases, they went after limited entry permits. Now, to clarify something, there have been a lot of limited entry permits seized. IRS has seized a number of limited entry permits, forced the sale of the limited entry permits, and that often means taking permits out of villages, selling them at bargain basement prices, and selling them to people out of state. Now, those permits, for one reason or another, haven't actually transferred, and that's often because the transfers come through us. There has often been a basis under state law to deny the transfer, which has led us to negotiate with the IRS. And to resist the forced sale of the limited entry permit. Now, the reason we have resisted is because we are protecting state law in the matter. State law has always declared that limited entry permits are privileges not subject to the claims of creditors for two important reasons. Probably the most important reason is that the state, I mean you, the legislature, wants control over this privilege so you can change it or modify it or do whatever you need to do. And it was the legislature that declared this to be a privilege. You may want to alter the program in the future, and the fact that this is a privilege gives you the power to do so. But the other stated reason for making it a privilege is to keep Alaskans in the water, people, especially rural people who may depend on their fisheries as their only source of cash income, keep those individuals in the water, maintain a source of income for their families and for their communities. I think it would be devastating to a number of communities to lose these particular privileges. And looking at fishermen in terms of compliance rates, I had access to some statistics a while back, and fishermen aren't less compliant than other small independent businessmen. I mean, if you look at cab drivers, if you look at lawyers, the rates of noncompliance are about the same. But the state, I mean, for its own reasons, has created the limited entry system, and the permits, they serve very useful purposes for the state, but they make fishermen especially vulnerable to this kind of tax enforcement. Because tax enforcers are bureaucrats like me. The easiest thing in the world is to snatch a limited entry permit and sell it. You can be done with the whole transaction and close a file and collect whatever money, although it's much less sometimes than the value of the permit from the sales we've observed. It's too easy. And so that's where the loan program has helped us intervene and negotiate with the IRS, help people who ran up against some of these enormous claims find some hope. It's helped the IRS find some patience to negotiate with them. And this has not been an inevitable process. I've seen people work themselves out from under this process through the loan program. It really has made a difference, and there are some opportunities through the IRS, offers and compromise and so forth, that have helped some Alaskans preserve their right to make a living, their right to work, basically. And the program has been most helpful. IRS has other means to collect the money. The state has also made it quite easy for IRS to go after the earnings from limited entry permits. I mean, through state records, the IRS knows every fish buyer who's out there. The state records every individual sale of fish. It's a simple matter for IRS to go after the earnings instead of going after the right to work that a limited entry permit represents. But in the past, they haven't had the patience to do that. Since this program was in place, and it's been one of the factors that has helped IRS to learn that it can exercise that patience, it can get paid off, and fishermen and their families and communities can retain the benefits of their local fisheries. And that's why we support this legislation.
Thank you very much, Representative Lynn and Representative Gatto.
I'm a little shocked to hear that there are actually some people in the United States who don't know that the IRS exists. And I would hope that something could be done to maybe contact our educational system. Need to teach reading, writing, and arithmetic, and apparently they need to teach that there's such a thing as IRS, and something needs to be done so this doesn't happen in the future. But in the meantime, is anything being done to get the word out before somebody gets in trouble?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, people, ever since we became aware of this problem, a number of forces through the university and some private forces like the Alaska Business Development Center and the state loan program have brought a lot of resources to bear on this, and the situation has greatly improved. But I can say this is not it's not a totally unique situation to Alaska. As a result of this work, the former Secretary of the Treasury, Paul O'Neill, appointed me to a national taxpayer advocacy panel. And one of the things we have learned is that there are other pockets in the population, including some recent immigrant groups who come from cultures where they don't have similar tax obligations, who are equally unaware. I mean, and the IRS has experience with these things. And Chuck Strani, when he came back, appreciated what he was up against. The IRS itself joined in the educational efforts, and together a number of groups went out, including the IRS. So I think a lot of resources have gone into the kind of education you're talking about, and a great deal of progress has been made and continues to be made. We're not in that situation now that Chuck Strami encountered, and it was in 1995 when he experienced that.
I want to make, if I may follow up, I just want to make it clear that I don't blame the populations, who don't know about this. I blame the, quote, system that allows this to happen. When we have, immigrants, as you state, who don't know this, our own indigenous populations who don't know this, and other people, probably throughout the United States, who knows. I blame the system. I don't blame the group. They are the victims more than the perpetrators. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, I'm sorry. Representative Gatto, your name was on my list. I forgot.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Chairman Tuomly. First, Tuomly? Tuomly? Tuomly. You make it so hard. I think you gave an extraordinarily good analysis and conclusion, and I'm completely with you. I'm just confused over something, though, and it's about the IRS. And I'll give you a different example and see if it makes any sense. I mean, I'm here by virtue of the government. They give me an office. They give me a key. I use the office. If I were to be kicked out and IRS says you owe us a lot of money, they can't come in my office and take it and rent it out because it's not mine. It's the state's. In the same way, if you have a limited entry permit, it's not that individual's, right? It's the state's. So how can the IRS walk in and take a permit to use something, such as I have a permit to use my office, and sell it? I don't get it.
Through the chair and Representative Gatto, I don't get it either. And you stated the state's theory. I mean, as between the state that issues this thing and the individual who gets it, It's a privilege under law. Now, it generates property rights because fishermen fish, money can be raised, that's clearly a property right. Fishermen can transfer the permits. Many transfer them to their own family members, but some do transfer them for value. That cash that's generated is a property right. But the thing itself, as between the state and individual fishermen, is a privilege. And it's critically important to the state that it remain that way because it's a means of enforcing conservation laws, among other things. You can jerk it if somebody violates the conservation laws. So that's exactly the issue between the state and the federal government.
Any other questions or comments?
I just wondered, and the resolution is?
We currently have an agreement to disagree.
I'm glad we're here.
But we're talking.
Okay, anybody, thank you, Representative Gatto. Any other comments? Anybody else from the audience like to testify? Yes, Jerry, would you please step up?
Chairman, thank you.
Thank you very much. Very, very enlightening, Mr. Quambly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry McCune. I Native Fishermen of Alaska. Native Fishermen of Alaska has also worked with fishermen. We advocate people pay their taxes and file their taxes on time. We do not advocate you don't pay your taxes. But one of the biggest things in UFA for this tax loan obligation program is to keep the IRS out. It's just a tool to keep the IRS from taking these permits. For example, a permit was seized in Yakutat 2 days before Christmas, and it was attempted to be sold for $5,000, which was worth $15,000. When the IRS knows that they have other assets they can get, they can make a deal with a processor for a fisherman to pay back their taxes, Mr. Chairman, or they can seize a boat that's paid for, which happened in Cordova. They seized a boat, they made a deal to pay their taxes off, but they didn't take the permit and the fella kept fishing, which I equate to the same as a mechanic's tools or a carpenter's tools. If you take them away, they can't work. And a lot of these villages and out, especially westward, like Mr. Trumley said, the education process has came a long ways in 10 years from when I first looked at the stats that showed people that were behind on their taxes or haven't even filed or didn't even know who IRS was. That's came a whole lot of ways. So for UFA, we advocate people pay their taxes, file on time, but this is one loan program, which is not, as is pointed out by Greg, it's not going to be used that much, but it does show that we're in good faith and keeps that IRS away from these permits till maybe 20 years from now. We might be able to settle this issue with them, but they're pretty stubborn fellows, I can tell you that much. So that's where we're at, Mr. Chairman. We support the bill.
Any questions of Mr. McCune? Are being, yes.
How many did you say you were with? I didn't catch that.
Native Fishermen of Alaska.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, yes.
I just want to add one more thing. As we go through this process, actually fishing in this particular year is not looking too bad in certain arenas. We've turned around a lot of things. Ocean Beauty is buying up some plants. It looks like there's some air freight available. I believe in the next 2 or 3 years that we have a good chance of getting the industry turned around where people can make a decent wage, and a lot of this is going to go away, and we can stabilize this somewhat. We have a little ways to go here, but I see some positive things happening, not just doom and gloom. There is some positive things looking up for this season. We have some bills in the legislature that's definitely going to help, and I think in the next couple of years you're going to see a turnaround in this important industry to the state.
I will invite you up to the brownwater fishery on the Yukon River, and after you see that, you won't be so sure about that.
Well, I'm very aware of working on that fishery, too, Mr. Chairman.
I wish that you folks would and realize that some of the fish do spawn in the rivers that come into the sea. Okay. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your comments about this being a good fishery and it might not be a problem, but is that a situation that... How much does that have to do with people not paying their taxes or forgetting or having a liability? I mean, the season would be one factor built into that. But aren't there other liabilities that would prevent people from being able to pay their taxes?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if I fully understand the question, but from the days of 10 years ago, and I can say from Cordova, there were some people that got behind on certain taxes, taking care of their family before they paid their taxes, like their house payments and stuff like that. it's came a long ways, and it's not that huge a problem in some areas. There's still out westward, there is a few problems because of two things. Same thing is going on in Yukon. Their runs were down, and their prices down at the same time. Now, whether you'd have to assess each one, I don't know why some people would owe taxes. Some people probably show a loss and wouldn't owe any taxes, I would imagine. But maybe I not fully understood your question.
Well,
follow up.
Well, there's a lot of factors. I mean, a good season doesn't necessarily mean that somebody's going to make a profit, or even if they're going to pay their taxes.
Well, I would say that you have to be, Mr. Chairman, a responsible person if you make a profit to pay your taxes. I'm not here to advocate bailing out fishermen or anybody else that doesn't pay their taxes. Like I said earlier, Mr. Chairman, is my main interest is a state's rights issue in this, to keep the IRS off having that program on the books, which is not being, as we see over the 10 years, it hasn't been used. As it went through those 2 years each, it's less and less use every year. So there's more and more education, and more people are being aware that, you know, you have to be responsible and pay your taxes or file, just like any other person. But having a good season, if you have a good season, it's obvious that if you went to the state loan program and you made $60,000 and you owe $20,000 in taxes, somewhere along the line they would look at that portfolio and say that I don't think that you're a very good risk because you didn't handle your money very well. I see you went on vacation here, and I see you did this and that, and the result was you didn't pay your taxes, not come to us for a loan. So that's kind of the loan program's job to look those kind of things over.
Okay, thank you.
One more
question.
I think along that lines, what's the average, is there a huge startup gearing up, buying fuel, food? How big of a startup? You've got to have the equipment before you can make a profit. It's no different than planting a crop. If one of those change of being a farmer, you've got to have a huge supply of seeds, or you're going to have the equipment to plow the fields. And I think, is there a big startup fee in commercial fishing in blue water?
Mr. Chairman, representing Morgan, that's a very good point because I forgot about that. Sometimes it depends on the fishery that you're in. You can spend anywhere from a couple thousand to $10,000 gearing up, and if the fish don't come back, you've just taken that money out, and you're still going to end up owing some kind of taxes. And if you don't owe any taxes, you're going to end up at least owing self-employment tax somewhere along the line. So there is a cost associated with starting up. I forgot.
Okay,
good point.
Thank you very much, Representative. Any other questions? Because we're going to close public comments this time, and I have no objection if somebody wants to make a motion to move this bill.
So moved.
There's an objection. There being none, this bill is moved out of this house. We will sign the yellow book.
Exactly what did you so move?
We will take up what some people have been waiting a long time for, and that is House Bill 191, which is the Coastal Zone Management. And we'll take just about a two-minute breather here. We'll call a quick ease. And for some reason, I had the proper draft, but I've just sent staff in to get it because we had two versions of the 422, one at 12-something and one at 130. And the later one at 130 is the proper draft on this thing. So with that, I'm going to have Marty Rutherford come up and testify. And while she's coming up, I might add that this bill tried to meet some of the problems that have been articulated by not only members of this committee, but of AOGA, certainly the governor's staff. And so it was a work in progress up until the 130 time that you see on the latest version of that draft. And so before we have Marty, you had a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I just wondered whether we should go into questions at this point or wait and have Ms. Rutherford do her presentation and then...
I'm going to have Marty Rutherford do a presentation first because she will probably go over some of those changes. And I want the people online to recognize that we had closed public hearing. I may reopen that public hearing. But first, we want to set some parameters here because of the changes and the new CS that has come out as a result of this cooperative effort. I want people to know so that if they don't have this draft or if they're going to ask questions, based on an old draft, why we don't want to spend too much time doing that. So Marty, thank you for being here very
thank
much.
Thank you.
You would proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. It is a pleasure to be back today. Perhaps I better note before I get started that Senate Resources does have the Senate version of this bill up at 3:30, and they are expecting me for that as well. For the record, my name is Marty Rutherford, and I'm here to represent the Department of Natural Resources and the administration and speak to this new committee substitute for House Bill 191, which you have in front of you. Once again, I'd like to note that I am under contract to the Department of Natural Resources. There are several members of the state team with me again today, and all of us will be available to answer the questions that you have as they arise. I'd like to introduce Mr. Rex Kostevin from the Department of Law. He's out of the room, it looks to me like, but Mr. Patrick Galvin, who is with the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Oil and Gas, and the past director of the Division of Governmental Coordination that used to house Coastal Management Program, and Mr. Randy Bates, who's the newly appointed Coastal Program Coordinator in the Alaska Coastal Management Program. As you said, Mr. Chairman, since the hearing last week, we have made additional changes to the committee substitute for House Bill 191, and they are reflected in this newest committee substitute that you are considering. Therefore, in addition to the committee substitute, you have in front of you some documents. At least I hope you do. Jim was going to hand them out. Did he do that, a packet of information?
No, I don't think he did.
What's in it?
It's a brief one-page synopsis of the committee substitute, which really is no different than the one you had last week. Virtually no changes in it. There's an updated timeline that identifies the milestones in the transition from the old to the new program. We had delivered those packets to Jim. I think he had them available. I know there were 20 of them at one point. I have another packet we could get copies made from.
Let's take a quick at ease. Does everybody have that, the one-page synopsis?
The Naval 23 here also.
Well, that's probably something slightly different.
Okay. I think we're ready to go, Marty. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So this one-page dated April 21 synopsis of the bill that's really unchanged from last week because it's very generic in nature. An updated timeline that also says April 21, 2003. It is reflective of the changes in the new CS. An updated chart, a comparison chart, that compares the newest committee substitute with the existing coastal management program, and it also does reflect the changes that are in the CS. And then there is an updated sectional analysis. You also have one sheet, I think you have one sheet anyway, that talks about the changes incorporated between last week's committee substitute and this committee substitute in front of you today.
Okay.
Yeah. What I'd like to do with your approval, Mr. Chairman, is to walk you through the changes made since last week's hearing, and at that time we can then address any questions you have.
Very good. Please continue.
All right. I'll proceed sequentially through the sections of the committee substitute. Section 3 adds the word maintenance of an improved district plan as eligible for funding assistance. This change was requested by the Alaska Municipal League and the Coastal Districts. Section 11 includes very specific statutory references to what was intended as DEC's air, land, and water.
Can I ask you a question? Sure. Rather than Section 11, can you just go to page and line when you do that? Is that possible?
I will try.
Otherwise, I just have to search
while you're
talking.
Intercede here. Whatever you would like to do, but if the sections are pretty clear in the bill here, you have to use the bill to follow along.
Mr. Chairman, my bill has section 11 on page 8. Mine is a double-sided version, though, so I hope that's accurate. Okay. Section 11 includes very specific statutory references to what was intended as DEC's air, land, and water quality requirements. This change was requested by Doug Mertz on behalf of the Prince William Sound RCAC. They were indicating they were concerned about the broadness of the air, land, and water quality references. Section 12, which is also on page 8,
extends the required renewal period of district plans from 5 to 10 years. Also, this change was requested by the Alaska Municipal League and the district coastal districts. Section 13, which is on my page 9, removes the addition of the term unduly in the type of restrictions a district plan can impose on a use of state concern. This is requested by Chairman Fate, and I believe Representative Seekins had some concerns about that word as well earlier. Sorry. Section 14, which is on page 10, there are several changes to this section. It amends AS 4640070, which sets out the requirement for department review and approval of district plans. It changes the introduction from the department may approve, which is a discretionary action, to a district plan meeting the requirements of A1 and 2, to the department shall approve a district plan if the commissioner finds that it meets the requirements. This change was requested by the Alaska Municipal League and the coastal districts. It also removes, same section, section 14, removes A2B as duplicative. I think several members on the committee requested that change, and we heard it also from the Alaska Municipal League and the coastal districts. It changes geographic area within the coastal zone in A2D to a defined portion of a district's coastal zone, and it changes identified, and this changes in A2D1, it changes identified to demonstrated as sensitive to development, demonstrated versus identified. And it deletes the phrase or
Say A2D1?
Yes, A2D1.
It's section 14.
Section 14, that's
section
right.
Section
14. A2C1, I'm sorry, it is A2C1.
Thank you.
Yes, so it changes the word in A2D1, or C1, identified to demonstrated. And it deletes the phrase or contemplated from A2C2 as redundant. We heard concern about that from various parties as well. Also in section 14, on my line 28, it is in A2C3, it adds local after usage to clarify that a matter of local concern must, among other requirements, involve local usage or scientific evidence. This change was requested by Chairman Fate. There is one error on this on your sheet. The next reference to section 19 should say section 20, and if anybody wants a new sheet, I have it here. Section 20. Just a moment, sir. Yes, section 20 is on page 12. It changes interested parties to affected parties in list of persons from whom DNR requests consistency review comments. This change was requested by Chairman Fate. In section 21, which is on page 13, it revises the lead-ins to 1A and B and revised B to reflect the listing of statutes instead of the simple term air, land, and water quality in AS 4640040B. And again, the intent is to ensure that the definition of air, land, and water quality is quite specific. Section 22 amends new subsection K, which is on page 13, governing the scope of a consistency review to add that are located. The administration thought that there was lack of clarity there, so we added those words ourselves. New subsection M, which on my bill is on page 14, adds the requirement that DNR establish in regulation the state resource agency permits and federal permits that trigger a consistency review. It also adds new subsections N and O, which establishes a 90-day deadline for completing consistency reviews. And it adds a new subsection P, which I believe is on page 15, which expressly states that a final consistency determination need not be held up by a DEC or other permit excluded under AS 4640-096G. Section 43, which I believe is back on page 21, adds a definition of project from the from 6AC 50, which are newly promulgated regulations dealing with consistency reviews, so it's consistent with the current regulations. Section 46B, which is on page 22, no, excuse me, yes, 46B, adds clarifying language that the former Coastal Policy Council's regulations implementing the Coastal Management Program remain in effect until DNR adopts new regulations or they are annulled under Section 45, whichever occurs first. This was done in order to provide the surety that Representative Cotula and her office requested. And Section 47, which is on page 23, is a transitional provision requiring revised coastal district coastal management plans, now gives all coastal districts 1 year after DNR adopts new regulations for the statewide standards, or until July 1, 2005, whichever is later, to submit revised district plans. And again, this was requested by the Alaska Municipal League, Coastal Districts, and Chairman Fate. Mr. Chairman, that completes my explanation of the changes made between last week's committee substitute and this week's committee substitute. We'd be glad to answer any questions, and again, I'll be referring questions to the most appropriate person who can answer them for you.
Artie, thank you very, very much.
Thank you. I'm sorry for the confusion.
Absolutely, you and the people you've worked with have done an absolutely astounding job on this, and it's been a hard job, but we've come out of this with a fairly clean piece of legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But I know that the committee is looking forward to really going over this. We did close public comment at the last meeting. However, as the chairman, I do have some prerogatives here, and we do have a group of people that have signed up online and offline, as a matter of fact, because they want to say something or testify. And so I'm going to open up public comment once more, and we will probably have public comment until it's time to adjourn today. So I want everybody to know that this bill will probably not get out today, but it will go out of here Friday. And I do have I'm simply going to move this bill out of this committee Friday. It's been well heard. We'll give people time to weigh in on it. But this is what we're going to do. So I just want to let my committee know and those people that are testifying know that I will move this bill out. So having said that, Marty, if you're comfortable there, I'm sure that maybe you can answer some questions as they come along.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Okay, we have, and we might just well start the way I'm picking these things up. We have Dana Olson from the Matsu LIO. Are you there, Dana?
Yes, I am.
Would you like to testify? Give us your name and your affiliation.
My name is Dana Olson, and I live in the Matsu Coastal District. I'm here at the Legislative Information Office here in Wasilla, and I had them fax down a reprint that I received. It's the April 2003 called The Powerhouse. It's from the Paragon Foundation, and it's a reprint called Chicago Biosphere Reserve Considered by Steering Committee. It's reprinted with permission of the Property Rights Foundation of America. And what I wanted to bring up to you is I think that your proposed legislation fails to consider that the U.S. MAB is short for the U.S. Man and Bionosphere Program, located within the Federal Department of State. It reviews and approves the nominations from the United States before forwarding them to the UN ESCO headquarters in Paris for formal designation, that you have failed to consider that by curtailing the political processes that are in our state currently, that there will be no access for submitting nominations for this. And I feel that I have commented a number of times on relevant issues, but one of the problems that that I feel that you're missing is that this establishes a criteria of urban interface. Just as the Miller's Reach Fire lawsuit is ongoing as an issue of intergovernmental agreements and policy and that interface issue. I really think that you need to address that because this 1970 Act does give us legal standing to go in and create nominations, whether or not you feel that you can curtail our political process or not. AS460340 is a requirement for an environmental plan that's never been implemented. Negotiated rulemaking does not provide for nominations, and it's anticipated that I will probably make recommendations for nominations, and it may impact your rulemaking, your permitting, while that process is ongoing. So anyway, I thought you might appreciate a copy of this, and I've asked them to fax that down to you.
Very good.
Lot of times we think that only wilderness can be put under such designation, but it's entirely untrue. Where there's been no consideration whatsoever on shallow gas, natural gas impacts to the local communities, I asked my local coastal district, the Matsu Borough, to provide me under a Freedom of Information Act the impact of that type of activity, and they have not yet provided it to me.
Okay, Dana, would you begin to wrap up? We're short of time, and we have a lot of people here.
Okay, and two, I've asked that the Matsu Borough also respond when I made a request for a permit standard that would allow a citizen group to determine whether or not the notice requirement that is required under the Alaska Constitution is being met, and that be a permanent part of their administrative process or their coastal district program. And they have not yet responded on that. So I guess that's where I'm at today. I don't feel that you've entirely looked at the issue in its entirety, and that I would suggest that you do so. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Let's go to the Kodiak LIO. Mike Milligan, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, hold your testimony down to not more than 3 minutes, hopefully two.
Yes, sir. My name is Mike Milligan. I'm here representing myself, and my comments will be of a general nature. I've been not have not been examining the minutiae of this, but I'm very alerted to any changes in the coastal zone management, Mr. Chairman. I served on the Borough Assembly here for 7 years, and during that time, we were able to use the coastal zone management program.